There is a price to be paid for being significantly overweight. Now, that's not a political statement. It's not an attempt to stir up the culture wars or encourage fat shaming. But studies all over the world tell us that obesity carries a heavy burden for individuals, society, and the economy. Now, one in three New Zealanders is considered obese. We have the fourth highest obesity rate in the OECD. And economist Professor John Corley from Cornell University in Washington has spent his career studying the economics of obesity. His research has shown that being roughly 29 kilos overweight lowers wages by about 9%. That's for white women. Professor Corley doesn't just look at the costs of rising obesity rates. He also looks at policies and programs that work to prevent and reduce them. And Professor John Corley joins me now. Hi.
Hi, Jesse. Thanks for having me.
Hey, why is economics a useful lens with which to view obesity?
Yeah, thanks for asking, because I think sometimes people have a misconception about what economics is, and they think it's just about sort of the business page of the newspaper. It's about stock markets and exchange rates, and it's that too. But economics is a social science. It's the study of why people do what they do. And as a result, economics is really useful for thinking about diet, physical activity, and weight, because in part it focuses on how people make decisions when there's trade-offs. And like one example of a really important trade-off with respect to obesity is that we all have to, you know, struggle with the trade-off of the immediate enjoyment of eating something that's sugary or fatty, and then the long-term consequence for our health. And likewise, when it comes to physical activity, people might find it sort of difficult or unpleasant to exercise. And so, you know, there's the desire to sort of not, you know, do something uncomfortable in the moment. But again, there's this long-term consequence to your health and maybe to other outcomes too from being sedentary.
Is defining obesity one of the trickier parts of your work?
So it's interesting. I mean, there is a standard definition of obesity, which is that, so first of all, it uses the body mass index, which is a measure of your weight for your height. It's your weight in kilograms divided by your height in meters squared. And so the standard definition of obesity is a BMI greater than or equal to 30. But that's somewhat controversial because BMI doesn't actually measure fat. It's just what's your weight and what's your height. And so it really risks misclassifying people. So like, I guess one example would be the All Blacks, right? Like, so you have these incredible athletes who are enormous, and clinically they're obese. Like, there's, you know, numerous, please don't repeat that name, but you know, I'm sure many of them have a BMI greater than 30, but we're not worried about them because they're extremely fit individuals. There's a lot of muscle there. And so that's a problem with BMI, is it doesn't distinguish muscle from fat. So other ways that one can measure that is there's a whole, like, you could use skin fold thicknesses as a way of measuring subcutaneous fat. There's some high-tech ways like dual X-ray absorptiometry, where you use two different like frequencies of radiation of X-rays, and that's a way of measuring a person's fat. So there are more accurate ways of measuring that. And by any measure, it's definitely true that the prevalence of obesity has risen over time in most countries of the world.
Yeah. I should also mention on BMI that it's been criticized as being quite culturally specific as well. I don't know if you have a view on that it's focused on, you know, Caucasian bodies.
Yeah, that's a great point. And there's been debate over the years about whether there should be culturally specific ones. One example of a group that has made a decision on this is the bariatric surgeons. So bariatric surgery is a way of sort of surgically addressing obesity. And they have very recently issued revised guidelines for who should be recommended bariatric surgery. And their threshold for most people is a BMI of 35 with no comorbidities. But they specify that, but for Asian populations, that BMI threshold should be much lower, 27.5 instead of 35. And so the argument is that different groups in the world sort of have different, you know, obesity can occur at different thresholds of BMI for different groups.
And that sort of nudges another topic, which is the cultural conversation, the social conversation around obesity. And I imagine you've seen that change a lot in the 20 years or so you've been involved in this work.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's interesting is you'd think that because obesity has become much more common, doubled or even tripled in many economically developed countries, you'd think that there would be less stigma over time. Like you'd think the more people are affected by this personally, the more normalized it would be. But there really isn't evidence of stigma decreasing. It continues to be something that people struggle with socially, and it's, pretty clearly something that also affects how physicians treat their patients with obesity and even the willingness of governments to spend money on programs to prevent and reduce obesity. So, for example, one issue here in the US is that there exist these drugs that can be quite effective for weight loss, and many health insurance programs do not cover them. Whether they're public health insurance programs by the government or private health insurance programs, there's a real sort of reluctance to cover them that some people attribute in part to this sort of bias, this belief of like, well, this is an individual problem. People should figure it out on your own, even when there exist these effective treatments.
Yeah, I think one concern that we often come across in our conversations on this show is the idea that there might be limited value in talking about the negative effects of obesity, negative impacts of obesity, given that obese people, well, some people believe that they don't have any control over their levels of obesity, given the, I'll say this in shorthand, the billions of dollars of marketing, the lack of healthy options, all that other sort of stuff, which makes it very difficult, if not impossible, not to be obese if you're born in a certain place at a certain time.
Yeah, so I think you're right. Like I think it requires nuance to accurately describe that situation. So I think there's absolutely, for example, a genetic component to this. And this isn't like opinion. There's genome-wide association studies that document there are these single nucleotide polymorphisms associated with higher BMI. And there are people who, in the genetic lottery, for reasons that have nothing to do with any decisions they've ever made, at birth are endowed with DNA that predisposes them to being heavier. And so I think, everyone should acknowledge that, when you're, thinking of someone with obesity or extreme obesity, it's not entirely, a level playing field. Some people, inherited a very sort of, different predisposition to obesity. But at the same time, right, it's just a predisposition. It's not destiny. Each of us, like our weight does respond to our behaviors. But also, one thing that's really important to remember is that when someone is already obese, already has obesity, already has extreme obesity, when they start losing weight, like when they're fasting, when they're exercising, like we all have this metabolism that will slow down. So, well before we actually start starving, our body acts as if we're starving. And so, when you've lost a certain amount of weight, even if you still have a lot of excess weight left, your metabolism will slow down and fight you losing more weight. And so this is an area where people then start to kind of despair and they feel like they've really plateaued, and no matter how hard they work and how much they fast, they just can't keep losing weight. And so I have a lot of sympathy too about that challenge that is just part of human nature.
I mentioned one of your studies, it's cited a lot, found that women who are about 29 kilos, 65 pounds overweight, are paid less than their thinner peers. But that's not just any woman, it's white women, not women of color. Doesn't apply to men. What do you make of that statistic?
Yeah, and so just for a little background, so it was long observed that heavier women earned less, and it just wasn't well understood whether that was causal or maybe there was just something different about women with obesity that also led them to earn less. And so what was the sort of innovation of this paper is using really like the heritability of weight as a natural experiment and using that as a way of estimating, is this really a causal relationship? And so what I found is that it is a causal relationship. Weight makes you earn less, but only for white females, not for Black or Hispanic females, and not for men. And this was with a US sample. Many, many sort of subsequent studies have examined other countries, and they also tend to find that women earn less in some, and the results for men are somewhat mixed. Some places find no relationship, sometimes it's a slight positive or slight negative relationship. But it is like kind of a really interesting finding because many stories that you would come up with for why weight would cause you to earn less should apply to more than just white females. So if you think like, well, but it's illness, it's injury, it's disability, well, but that should apply to men too. And one thing that's interesting is that wages begin falling with BMI or weight at a pretty low level. And so it's not that, oh, these people are like experiencing mobility issues or type 2 diabetes. I mean, it pretty clearly seems to be a return to appearance. So in other words, kind of bias. And some supporting evidence of this is this really interesting study that was done in Scandinavia. And apparently in Sweden, it's practice to attach your photograph when you apply for a job. And so these researchers manipulated photographs to make the person look either heavier or lighter. And what they found is that the heavier version of the person was significantly less likely to get an initial job interview. And so the resumes are identical. Only thing that's manipulated is the picture. And that picture manipulation seems to cause this. So it does seem at least part of this is due to bias. Some sociological research suggests that white females' own self-esteem may be more affected by excess weight than Black or Hispanic females or men. So it's possible that that's another mechanism as well.
Here's another curious one. By the way, if you've just tuned in, I'm talking to Professor John Cawley from Cornell University at Washington, D.C. He's spent his career studying the economics of obesity. So, how about this one? The Economist recently did a piece called The Economics of Thinness, and you took part in a podcast, I think, about it. That piece centered on a study that says that the richer people are, the thinner they tend to be, that rich women are thinner than poor women. But rich and poor men are about the same. What are your thoughts on that?
Yep, so you accurately described it. So, for example, in the US, for men, there really isn't much of a difference in weight between low income, middle income, and high income men. But to the extent there is a difference, it's actually the lowest income men who have the lowest prevalence of obesity. So, obesity and income are actually positively correlated for men, whereas for women, it's the reverse, and it's a much more dramatic, strong relationship. So, high income women have a much lower prevalence of obesity than lower income women. So part of the explanation for this gender difference could be due to the fact that this obesity is defined using body mass index or BMI. And again, BMI doesn't distinguish fat from muscle. And so for men in particular, there may be sort of a lot of unobserved heterogeneity in muscle mass across those groups. We don't see as much variation in muscle mass among women. And so that could be why we see a stronger relationship with BMI for them. And there's been some really interesting work on whether income itself has a causal impact. Sorry, if income has a causal impact on weight. So I talked before about like, are your wages affected by your weight? So another question is, does your income affect your weight? And so, there's been a variety of studies, some of which have used like variation in the amount of retirement benefits that people get from the government, or the timing of welfare payments, or whether Native Americans are getting payments from their tribe or not. So a whole variety of even lottery winnings. And what these studies tend to find is that there really tends not to be an effect of income on weight for middle income or high income people, but there can be for low income people. So if you give more money to very low income, very poor people, that may lead them to spend more money on food and to gain weight. But for other groups, no.
What are some of the medical costs of obesity?
Yeah, so I mean, obesity. So I used to think of fat as just like extra weight we carried around, like that didn't do anything, was completely inert. And it turns out, like, fat actually collectively, our fat cells are an endocrine organ that secrete hormones, and those hormones are harmful to our health. So, for example, they secrete resistin, which causes insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes. They secrete leptin, which causes cardiovascular problems, contributing to strokes and heart attacks. And so it turns out, so we've, with Chad Meyerhofer and Adam Beener, my co-authors, we've looked at the association of medical care costs with body mass index. And what we found is that really medical care costs do not start rising even in the obese range very much. It's really when we're talking about like extreme or morbid obesity where medical costs, care costs really go up exponentially. So having a BMI of like 31, your medical care costs really aren't that much higher than 29, even though the first person's above the threshold for obesity and the second isn't. But when people have like a BMI of 35, 40, that's where you see a lot of type 2 diabetes, a lot of emergency room visits, inpatient hospital stays. And so obesity raises medical care costs, basically doubles them. So in the US, obesity raises medical care costs by $2,700 a year. And that's a much higher figure when we're talking about extreme obesity. And I assume people remember too that it came out during COVID that people who had obesity had much worse outcomes from COVID. And so there were significantly higher risks of somebody having to go into the intensive care unit or, you know, dying from COVID if they also had obesity. So it really is something that affects, you know, your welfare and your medical care costs across a whole lot of different conditions.
I feel like I saw a bit of pushback against that. Not pushback against the fact necessarily, but a reluctance to link obesity to poorer outcomes when you got COVID. Did you see any of that over the last couple of years? A sort of a resistance to talking about that or you know, to saying it out loud?
I mean, so that's an interesting question. I mean, I think, you know, in the medical journals, there were some very shocking, eye-opening results about how much worse outcomes were for COVID patients who had obesity. But you're right that it's kind of gone silent. Like there has not been much subsequent discussion of that in the last year or so. So I'm not sure that, you know, it's sort of, we sort of learned lessons from that.
Yeah. What are the costs, by the way? You know, it doesn't stop at that extra $2,700 a year in medical costs, I'm presuming. There must be other costs to productivity and, and economic output.
Yep, absolutely. So, I mean, another form of, another type of cost for obesity is sort of workplace-related costs. And I already mentioned how it affects, you know, white females' wages. But another relevant outcome is job absenteeism. So how much are people missing work for poor health? And so with my co-authors, Chad Meyerhofer and Adam Biener, we found that obesity basically doubles the number of workdays that people miss due to poor health. A whole other category of workplace costs is what's called presenteeism, where people aren't missing work, mm-hmm. but they're less productive when at work. And that's actually really hard to measure. And we, you know, I don't think anybody really has a good estimate of what those costs are.
Are you surprised, given all these costs, all these downsides, that more isn't being done on an individual and public health basis to address obesity?
So I guess I would put it this way. I am impressed by how much so many different groups are trying to do. I think there's many governments that are being innovative and trying lots of different things. I think groups like schools, health insurance companies, employers are thinking creatively. And the unfortunate thing is that obesity is still continuing to rise. And so that doesn't mean that everything's ineffective, but I think it seems pretty clear that there's no single magic bullet, and it's going to take a lot of different policies, each having an incremental effect for us to see meaningful impacts.
How do you apply economic principles to help people and help governments who want to help?
Yeah, so one, you know, arguably one of the most common responses that governments have is to tax sugar-sweetened beverages. So like, just to clarify, obesity is not due to consuming any one thing.
Yeah.
It's due to an entire diet, physical activity lifestyle. But, you know, certain groups have targeted sugar-sweetened beverages in particular because they're widely consumed, they have no nutrients, they have high calories, and frequently in the past, they've been advertised to children. And so I know in New Zealand, there's been this really interesting sort of voluntary industry initiative to reduce that food advertising to children, take them out of schools, even reformulate the products. And in addition to that, many governments have passed taxes on sugar-sweetened beverages. And so that's something I and other economists have really enjoyed studying because it's a relatively new policy. It's happening in many places.
Yeah.
The design of the taxes is different. And so, for example, in the Middle East, they have some of the highest sugar-sweetened beverage taxes in the world, where it's like 50% tax on sugar-sweetened beverages and 100% tax on energy drinks. And so that is one really interesting sort of economic tool that governments are using. And it seems that they definitely raise prices. They definitely reduce purchases and consumption. I should say purchases and sales, and then maybe less of an impact on consumption. And we really don't have evidence from many countries yet about the impact on BMI or weight.
Are you optimistic that those taxes might work?
So they definitely do work to raise prices and reduce sales and purchases.
Sorry, that they might impact obesity positively.
So I think it is one important tool to use. So if As I said before, there's no magic bullet. It's going to take a number of things, a whole suite of policies. And if you sort of told me that I, as an economist, got to design the tax any way I wanted, I would make it broader than just as sugar sweetened beverages. I would make it for all non-nutritious, energy dense foods. Energy dense just means high calorie. And I would make the size of the tax proportional to our sense of the health harm of the product. So the city level soda taxes that we have in the US, they don't tend to vary based on the contents of the drink. It's just like 1 cent per ounce, for example, regardless of how caloric it is. I mean, if it's 0 calories, then it's exempt. But whereas in the UK, for example, it's a two-tiered tax where there's at least, there's ones that don't have to pay any tax. There's a low tax for low sugar, and there's a high tax for high sugar. And then there's like in a place like France, where the size of the tax is proportional to how much sugar is in the drink. It's not just two tiers, it's like a linear relationship. So I support more of the linear relationship because it gives incentives for the manufacturers to keep reformulating, keep trying to get the sugar down, because the extent to which they can reduce the calories, they can also reduce the tax. And the UK tax, which is very similar to the one in Ireland, that has been very successful in encouraging manufacturers to reformulate. They gave the manufacturers early information about this is the design of the tax, this is when it's going to be implemented, and we'd love to see you get your, reformulate and get below the high tax into that lower category. And a whole bunch of drinks really did reformulate just below the threshold that qualifies them for the lower tax.
And your points regarding no magic bullets notwithstanding, anything we might not have thought of, which could be a useful way of addressing obesity in terms of regulation?
So one thing that I support, it's again not a magic bullet, but I think it makes a lot of sense, is making sure that there's clear and understandable information both on restaurant menus and on packaged foods. And so, for example, we did randomized experiments in restaurants where some menus were just normal and had no calorie information, and then other menus did have that calorie information. And having the calories listed on the menu reduced the number of calories that people ordered for dinner by 3%. So again, not a magic bullet, but it's a cheap way of giving people the information they're otherwise missing, allowing them to make fully informed decisions, and happens to result in reduced number of calories ordered. There's really innovative stuff happening in different countries. So, for example, in different Pacific Island nations, they've implemented sometimes import duties or even bans on certain cuts of meat. So, for example, banning really high fat cuts of meat like turkey tails or mutton flaps, which again, this may be particularly relevant to, New Zealand, given the mutton connection there.
Well, Pacific Islands, I think, which we export to, I think mutton flaps are a pretty sought after product.
Right, which is precisely why some of those countries are trying to reduce population consumption of them. South Africa, there's an health insurance plan there called Discovery, which created this program called Vitality, which gives basically, it's like frequent flyer points to their enrollees when they do healthy behaviors. So if you go and if you quit smoking, you get a certain number of points. If you lose weight, you get a certain number of points. If you go for your mammogram or colonoscopy, you get a certain number of points. And you can use these points for shopping or entertainment. And so it's really taken like gamification of health to a whole other level. Yeah, so really interesting things happening worldwide.
Fantastic. Thank you for your analysis today, John. Really lovely to spend some time with you and look forward to your future research with interest.
Thanks very much. Look forward to seeing the Women's World Cup this summer.
Oh, yeah. You going to come out for it or are you watching on TV?
I'd love to come out, but it'll be on TV for me.
Yeah, great. Okay, thanks, John.
Take care. Bye bye.